It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. As we're hearing in the news today, there's still a lot that we don't know about the shooting at Abundant Life Christian School in Madison on Monday.
A teacher and a student were fatally shot at the school. Six others were injured during the attack. And Madison police say the shooter, a 15-year-old student, died of an apparent self-inflicted gunshot. Police now are focusing on investigating possible motives.
We're getting reactions to the shooting now. Mark Pocan is a Democratic member of Congress. His district includes Dane County, where the shooting took place. Representative Pocan, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thanks for having me.
There have been over 300 school shootings around the country this year, two in your district, another in May in Mount Horeb, and police fatally shot a student who'd pointed a pellet gun at them. What are you hearing from constituents about how this kind of violence affects them?
Well, this has obviously impacted the community. And, you know, last night I couldn't be there. I'm in Washington, but I think there were about 700 people at a vigil. You should believe that when you drop your child off at school, they're going to be safe and they're going to be coming home at the end of the day. And to have this happen now in our backyard, but honestly, it's happened all across the country way too many times. It's a uniquely American problem. This is a United States problem. Of having this many mass shootings, this many school shootings, and the fact that we really do nothing about it. Until we accept that the problem is we have an epidemic of gun violence and we have not addressed it, this is going to happen in more school districts across the country.
You've sponsored a number of bills that would increase gun control measures and or boost youth mental health care. Can you give us an overview of some of your top priorities?
You know, honestly, what this has really reinforced for me is this is a 30,000-foot conversation first. We have to accept that no other country on the planet has this problem. And, you know, it's great to be number one in many categories. This is not one you want to be number one in. And once we accept that this is a uniquely American problem, you figure out what that problem is. We're not there yet. So, you know, there are some common sense things like expanded background checks for people who, you know, are buying a gun off of Craigslist and can, you know, have a bag of cash in a parking lot of a Walmart to buying a gun, not having a background check, to more resources for mental health. But at the end of the day, we have to accept that this is an epidemic. And when you have an epidemic of COVID, we reacted. But when we have an epidemic of gun violence, we do nothing.
In a news release on Monday, you told your Republican colleagues to, quoting here, grow a backbone and put our children above the gun lobby, end quote. Do you see any movement, any reaction from Republicans on this issue?
No, and that's a big part of the problem. You know, the gun lobby in Washington is essentially the gun manufacturers. That's who funds the NRA. It's not people back home who are members of the NRA and want to make sure that they can keep their heritage of hunting for their family. No one is going after anyone's hunting rifle, period. But the gun manufacturers know that we have more guns in this country than people, and they make a lot of money. And just most recently, they had some new device that you could add to a gun to make it an automatic gun. That's the wrong direction. And these gun manufacturers are the ones that really are at the forefront of stopping us from doing many of the things we need to do to protect our children. So, you know, they are the bad folks out there. And we need to also understand that every time we just, you know, do nothing in response to the gun manufacturers, we are doing something. We're just making our children less safe. And that is something that is demonstrative.
To be clear, those auto sear or switch devices are not being manufactured by the gun manufacturers. Those are illegal imports or homemade pieces. But there have been accusations that companies like Glock aren't doing enough to prevent those from being added to guns. Are there things that you think under current law and understandings of law could be done to make guns safer and to keep them out of the wrong hands?
So for semantics, gun manufacturing industry, right? That is people who also make add-on parts. But that is an industry that blocks us from all of this. So just to get the semantics correct, since we're going to. But we really need to make sure that we do the common sense things that we can do. There's like over 85% public support alone for the expanded background checks. Why aren't we getting those things done? And we need to. But more importantly, I'm going to take it right back, Rob, to 30,000 foot. We have to say that there's a problem first, because until we do, we're not really going to get some of these other things done in state legislatures and in Congress. So that's our real problem. But, This is a uniquely United States problem that we are just unwilling to accept is a problem.
What would you say to parents, to people who have been affected by gun violence, especially in schools, who maybe want to see the action you're talking about, may have lost hope, lost faith that Congress will ever do anything?
Yeah, I think we just need to speak out more and make this an issue that if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I think, reaching out to your elected officials on a regular basis about things like this is important. The gun lobby in Washington has a lot of money, and that seems to sway a lot of members of Congress and state legislatures on how they decide things. But at the end of the day, it's your constituents that vote for your elected officials, and we have more power, but we have to make this issue as much as a priority as we do other issues and accept that it's an epidemic. It's an epidemic of gun violence, and we need to treat it like a public health emergency.
Representative Pocan, thanks again for joining us today.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Mark Pocan, member of Wisconsin's congressional delegation. His district includes Dane County, where there have been two school shootings this year, including this week in Madison. Now let's hear from Trish Kilpin, director of the Wisconsin Department of Justice's Office of School Safety. Trish, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Trish, I just want to hear your reaction to this week's shooting at a school in Madison from your vantage at the Office of School Safety.
It's truly devastating. I got the news as it was happening and responded to that community, helping with reunification of children and their families, helping to ensure that families and staff members got what they need to deal with the unimaginable. For those of us who spend our careers focused on preventing violence, having an act of violence here in Wisconsin is just heartbreaking.
I want to focus on your office's prevention efforts here. That includes the Speak Up, Speak Out program. It encourages students and adults to report when they observe children in crisis. Can you talk about that program and how effective you've seen it at preventing school violence?
Absolutely. The research was really clear even 25 years ago after Columbine, when the analysis was done about what could have prevented that shooting. And it pointed to the fact that communities, kids, families have to have access to a confidential reporting system where they can share information about concerns for planned school attacks. And that is how these threat reporting lines started. And here in Wisconsin, we started ours in 2020. And what we're seeing is tremendous use of the system. We have received over 13,000 tips to SUSO. And yes, it does prevent violence. That is clear with the research. But we also see a real broad diffusion of benefits. Interestingly, when a child decides, and I say the word decides very purposefully, because they plan to conduct a school attack. A school shooting does not just happen. Someone does not just snap one day. Instead, they are premeditated, and there's lots of research and planning that goes into these attacks. And when that person is planning the school violence event, they demonstrate behaviors that are observable to others. And this is what we want people to report to SUSO. We want to turn bystanders, people who witness things, to upstanders who are sharing information so violence can be prevented. So we have received more than 380 specific tips about youth in Wisconsin planning school attacks, and those could be managed in real time, delivered to local communities for assessment so that that school can determine if it's safe to have school, if it's safe to stay open, what they can do. And SUSO is a huge part of that.
For people listening who are teachers, school administrators, parents of kids in schools, what do you recommend to embrace things like Speak Up and Speak Out and to provide help for kids before they make that decision?
Good question. I believe that SUSO works best when it's part of a healthy school culture that embraces help seeking, when it's not about tattling on kids or telling on them. It's about something is wrong, something a classmate or yourself is doing is not okay, and support is needed. Interestingly, when we examine school shootings, In all school shootings, it starts with a grievance or an upset. And then if someone decides to use violence towards that upset, then they progress down what we call a pathway to violence. Grievances and upset are things that if we handled at that early intervention point, we could preventing somebody from further deteriorating in terms of their coping and their mental health and how they approach their problem. We have received most of our tips in SUSO. Of the over 13,000 tips that we've received, over 4,000 are about bullying. So I think it's super important to have that opportunity to deliver that to the schools so they can intervene early.
On top of this week's tragedy, the Madison School District reported yesterday that officials received hoax calls of a person claiming there was a person in crisis with a weapon outside of school buildings. How common are hoax reports like this, and what kind of damage do they do just in our last minute or so?
Yeah, they do a huge amount of damage. Anytime we're having school and school staff and families think that they are in danger, that is something that's very difficult for them to process, and it's difficult for them to learn when they feel in danger. Squatting calls are a problem. These hoax calls and concerns and threats do increase after an attack, and we see sometimes some copycat and some contagion, and these need to be reported to local authorities. So, or to SUSO so that we can investigate those and put a stop to it. It's not okay to make these types of threats.
Trish, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Trish Kilpin, Director of the Wisconsin Department of Justice's Office of School Safety. We also heard from Congressional Representative Mark Pocan. Also want to hear from you. You can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. You can just share your thoughts in reaction to this week's tragedy and maybe share your perspective as a parent, a student, a teacher, an administrator, school staff. What kind of things has your district done that you think might boost safety? What else do you want to see done? Again, email wisconsintoday@wpr.org with your thoughts and experiences.
Coming up, almost half of Wisconsin is covered by forest lands. A new report shows how they are vulnerable and deeply connected to our way of life here.
They serve all kinds of recreational, ecological, social, and economic interests to all the people.
Threats to forests and a vision for conservation, that's next on Wisconsin Today.
Here it's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Almost half of Wisconsin is covered by forests. And our state's woodlands face a wide range of threats, from invasive pests to an unstable pulp and paper industry.
A new report by the conservation group Wisconsin's Green Fire says less diverse and complex forests in our state creates new challenges for the $38 billion forest products industry here.
Ron Eckstein is chair of public lands and forestry for Wisconsin's Green Fire and one of the contributors to its new report called Wisconsin Forests at Risk. Ron, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Glad to be here.
The report says the forest products industry in particular has a really outsized role here in managing the state's forests in healthy ways. And I'm wondering, how can an industry that is primarily based on using these resources, on cutting down trees, how can that benefit forest health overall?
Well, most of our forests in the state fall into two categories. Some of them have a whole bunch of tree species like maples and basswoods that don't require much disturbance. You can let them grow, maybe thin them and so forth to produce healthy forests. But many other kinds of forests, the white pine forest, jack pine, red pine forest, the white birch forest, aspen forest, and in particular, all of our all different kinds of oak forests, they need disturbance. They all started in pre-settlement times before there was fire control. So Native Americans did a really good job of setting fires, to produce blueberries, to drive game. So almost all the forests in southern Wisconsin and were oak forests that were burnt regularly. Not giant fires that burnt the canopy and everything, but ground fires. And this set the stage for the development of, again, all our oak forests, white birch forests, pine forests. You fast forward to today, the forests have grown up, but we no longer have either wildfire or Native Americans burning all over the landscape. And so it takes an alternate type of activity to manage these forests. About half of our forests in the state need full sun to grow, to reproduce and grow. They're sort of like tomatoes. You can't grow them in the shade. Other forests you can. And to grow those forests in the full sun, you need to open the canopy. And the way to do that on a broad scale is with the forest products industry. So it works out fairly well, really hand in hand, the forest products industry with landowners and loggers and truckers and mills and wildlife biologists and forest managers can work very well together to both nurture the forests we have, keep them healthy, thin forests as needed, and regenerate forests in the absence of fire.
When the mills and the lumber and the pulp and paper factories are in a vulnerable condition, they're unstable, they're changing, some are closing, what effect is that having on our forests and conservation?
Well, it lacked what happens when we don't have good markets for a variety of forest products. And forest products fall into all kinds of categories. Generally, there's saw timber type products to make lumber out of, 2x4s and things like that. And then there's pulpwood market, the market for small wood, small diameter wood that makes, you know, paper products. And Wisconsin has been and is still continues to be a leader in the pulp and paper industry. And to manage our forests, you need a market for small wood. It's called a market for small wood. So to thin a maple forest, you need to take out 6-inch, 10, 8-inch diameter trees in a thinning process to allow the remaining trees to grow. In our oak forest, you need to keep them thinned and take out competition where you don't want them to turn into maple or basswood. You want them to stay oak. You have to take out the small wood. The whole aspen and white birch and jackpine forests that are very beneficial to all kinds of plants and animals require almost full sun to grow. And so you need clear-cut type forests that get full sun. And so the forest products industry, what it does is it works with landowners, private landowners. Most of the forests in the state are held by private landowners, small landowners, 40, 80 acres, some big corporations. But most of them are private landowners, and they don't have the wherewithal to by themselves work the thin forest and do all that work. They require the logger and the forest products industry to do that for them, to keep forests healthy and regenerate forests and allow them to grow into older age classes.
Are there any ideas floating out there or through Wisconsin's Green Fire if we continue to see a shrinking or decline of the forest products industry, what alternatives are there for properly managing the woodlands in our state?
Well, the alternatives are not many. We really do need the forest products industry. They do all kinds of things. I'm a specialist in wildlife habitat, and everything from prairie chickens, I need open landscape, sharp-tailed grouse populations in the Northwest that need big open more landscapes, rough grouse, deer, all the forest game species, all the way up through American martens that require old and old growth forests and all kinds of plants and animals like older forests. We need the forest products industry to do that. The individual landowners, county forest system, state forest, national forest system certainly don't have the staff or funding to do it on their own. So we need to have that long-term partnership between land managers, ecologists, biologists, conservationists, and loggers and mills to make this all happen. And right now, in Wisconsin. It's 100 years since the tragedy of the 1920s, and Wisconsinites came together to help the forests. There are headwinds now, and that's everything. Not only the forest products industry is losing mills, closing mills, their markets are shrinking, but pests and pathogens, insect pests and pathogens, invasive things are really hard hitting our forests. Climate is changing the way forests grow and how healthy they are. Deer, large populations of deer in certain parts of the state are overbrowsing young reproduction in forests. So there are many of these things that are affecting forests. And what we need today is to take a look. The purpose of the report was to put together a group of experts, people that we put together, forest managers, forest ecologists and researchers, people with forest products industry, a wildlife biologist, that was me, and the perspective of the Native American tribes, and to write this report and bring to the attention of policymakers and community leaders and investors, forest managers, put in one place kind of all the headwinds and some of the big problems they're facing our forests, and hope that those folks, especially people making decisions on policy, will come together and produce the kind of funding and staffing and research that's needed to look at these problems and come out with the best possible result at the end of the day.
We are talking about the threats to forest lands in Wisconsin. Ron Eckstein is with us, public lands and forestry chair at Wisconsin's Greenfire. And the conservation group recently published this report called Wisconsin Forests at Risk. Ron, let's go deeper now into the invasive species. The invasive emerald ash borer is found in every county in the state. Your report states that. And what tree species are at risk when you're talking about losing over 1 billion ash trees in forests?
Right. Well, ash, the group of ash trees in Wisconsin is one of the quite a few other trees that are facing pests and pathogens. But right now, certainly our ash forests, the great bulk that you see as you're driving along the highway throughout Southeast Wisconsin in particular, and it's gonna be, you know, statewide in big numbers very soon, are black ash trees, which are trees that grow in forested wetlands. But there are also upland ash trees that grow on, you know, out of the wetlands, white ash, and green ash. There are a couple other very minor ones in the far southeastern part of the state. But this imported non-native pest, the emerald ash borer, has no predators. And it's really, the trajectory right now is it's gonna kill just about every ash tree in Wisconsin. And when that happens, those forested wetlands will change. Some of them will change into a shrub community rather than a forest community because the trees won't be there to bring up the water and keep it drier in these wetland areas. When we lose our ash forest, we'll lose a host of biological diversity, all kinds of beneficial insects and everything, many, many that live in ash, those ash forests. So it's just gonna be a dramatic change. We've already lost most of our elm forests of a couple different species.
And I want to find out, what were those lessons learned from the devastation of elms? Can we apply that here in the future or with the emerald ash borer?
What it takes to attack these pests in particular, these invasive pests, they're so fast acting. They have no predators, no fungus or disease things that hit them. And the research, it takes research to find out what we can do. And it typically what happens is they overwhelm us before we are able to put together answers to that question. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening with the emerald ash borer. you know, it's in much of the eastern United States now, and many state agencies and the federal government have been looking at solutions, and so far, none. There are some lingering ash trees that seem to be not susceptible, so there is hope for the distant future, but right now it doesn't look very good. Mm. On the horizon, there are other things in the eastern forests, and as far west now as Michigan, there's the hemlock woolly adelgid, a tiny little insect pest that's completely devastating the eastern hemlock forests. Pretty much wiped out hemlock in the Appalachian Mountains, much of Pennsylvania, Tennessee. It's now in Michigan. Michigan DNR is spending $2 million a year to try to combat it, to keep it from spreading. And we think that in the next 3, 4, 5 years, it's going to either go around the Upper Peninsula and come into Wisconsin, or drift across, fly across with the wind across Lake Michigan and enter Wisconsin. So we have to be prepared with staff and budgets, because we know that pest is just on our doorstep.
It's on the horizon. Yeah. With that rapidly changing climate and the impacts on our forest land, you know, the report really encourages increased investment in research and product development and new incentives for forest products that can look at these long-term issues. What might this research and development look like in the forestry industry in Wisconsin? What could ultimately help boost another century of conservation through R&D?
Yes, what there is a group in Wisconsin called the Council on Forestry. It's an integrated group of forest products industry. It's called the Governor's Council on Forestry. And they work, they've been working a long time, bringing together the saw timber industry, the pulp paper industry, the loggers, the foresters, university, state DNR, National Forest, everybody they can think of to develop strategies. So they're recommending in the next budget for the state of Wisconsin a program to fund a marketing and development process to have mills upgrade, to have new mills come into the state, to look at new forest products. And so anyway, they have a big report. They've been working on it for years, but they need some funding from the state to make that happen. And that's going to help with the, you know, keeping mills operating and that part of it. The other part is funding research at the university system in Wisconsin DNR, Forest Service, to look at markets, look at pests and pathogens, look at the best possible way to address climate change when we're moving forward. And so what our report does is not, we don't have a solution for all of these big things that are happening, but our recommendation is for policymakers, community leaders, people interested in forests, that this is a call to action, that we need to do something.
Ron, before I have to let you go, I want to ask a deeply personal question, that when you find yourself out in a forest in Wisconsin, how does it make it you feel? What thoughts come up in your mind? What words come to mind?
Well, you know, I know a lot of people, and most of my contacts are with ecologists and biologists, you know, through my long career with DNR. And what we can see are the problems. You know, a normal person, say a person driving through the forests of Wisconsin in their car, they drive along and they see beautiful trees, kind of a green blur as they're going along at 50, 60 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. And it seems, well, there's trees. But what we know is, yeah, yes, there are trees, but there are a lot of problems here. You know, I drive to Madison and I see a beautiful oak forest with a complete understory of buckthorn shrubs. There's no way those oaks can reproduce with that in there. And there's no way that a landowner can control that buckthorn without some help funding or something. I see, you know, dead ash trees all over the place. On my own property here, we finally had a few elm trees growing up after the last disease came through about 30 years ago in our area. And then the last couple of years ago, it came through again and killed the rest of them. So I'm always hopeful. I see good things happening in some areas, and I see, you know, neglect in some other areas. Landowners don't have the wherewithal or the knowledge to do what's needed to, say, manage their oak forests. And other places I see landowners doing the wrong thing, they're over-harvesting, high-grading, you know, cutting just the most valuable trees and leaving the wrong trees in place. So what it takes is, you know, foresters, wildlife biologists to, whenever possible, get the best possible information out to all kinds of landowners to make sure our forests stay as healthy as they possibly can be in the face of these headwinds.
Well, Ron, thank you for sharing the report, and thank you for joining us.
You bet.
Ron Eckstein is chair of public lands and forestry for Wisconsin's Green Fire. That's a nonprofit conservation organization. We've been talking about its new report highlighting the economic and environmental threats to Wisconsin forests and future ways to safeguard these lands. The report is called Wisconsin Forests at Risk.
Coming up, get a taste of a unique Wisconsin crop and find out what gives horseradish its powerful flavor.
We actually would call that the Zing, and we developed a heat index for horseradish called the Zing Factor.
That's coming up on Wisconsin Today. You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCullum with a story about Dungeons and Dragons, a game that turns 50 this year.
The tabletop role-playing game Dungeons and Dragons has deep roots in Wisconsin. It was co-created here in Lake Geneva by Gary Gygax. D&D is beloved around the world and played regularly in places like Madison.
It's theater of the mind. You're thinking of things, and you're sort of creating the world in your head.
There are, like, set rules according to the books, but even those can be bent just to, like, kind of tell the story.
You can just come straight from work, escape whatever you were doing, and hang out and be in a fantasy.
Those are Dungeons & Dragons players who WPR's Anna Marie Yanni talked with at a game shop in Madison, a space that hosts weekly D&D nights.
What I noticed most was the laughter.
Oh, I'm having a full-blown panic attack right now.
For a game where you're trying to fight imaginary monsters and keep the character you're playing alive, the mood is light.
It's like a smartphone. Actually, closer to a brick, yeah.
Nokia brick, I love
it. It's a brick.
The Beholder gave us a burn.
But more like
this table of D&D players at Misty Mountain Games in Madison gather every Thursday for a few hours. The game is played with dice, a handbook, and the players' imaginations. Currently, the players are trying to decide how to crack a burner phone that a creature in the game gave them. Their adventure is led by a so-called Dungeon Master, or DM. This table's DM is Samara Kushtim.
An uncountable number of blazing orbs of fire plummet to different points of the city.
The DM sits at the head of the table. They play the monsters. They run the show. It's an adventure with alternate endings, depending on what path the players decide to take or how they roll their many-sided die.
one of which striking the Senate hall. I need all of you to make a dexterity saving throw, DC 17.
Don't let go of the brick wall.
I can't roll that many dice.
Oh my gosh, so that's a nat one.
When she's DMing, Kushtib works to make sure everyone at the table feels included.
Like, Dungeons & Dragons has kept me, like, feeling like I have a home no matter where I move. Because I was, like, first in, like, very eastern Wisconsin, then I was playing a game in, like, northern Wisconsin, now I'm here in Madison. It's, like, this is something that always kind of sticks around, is, like, I can insert myself here and feel like I'm part of a community.
Since the game's launch in 1974, millions of people have played it around the world. It's also featured in Netflix's hit show Stranger Things. At another table, co-organizer Joe Alfano says he was a Stranger Things kid.
I've been playing for 45 of the 50 years it's been around. I started in middle school, literally just down the road.
A few years back, Alfano had a stint in the hospital. The doctor asked him what he wanted to do when he got out.
And I just said, you know, that's what I want to come back to. I've got a community of people. I've got family. I've got friends. I've got friends that are like family, and I want to get back to playing with them. And so, yeah, I won't give this up. Never.
Go no farther, he warns, lest this cursed monument overtake you. Only death awaits you in these halls.
Tonight, he's at a table with his 33-year-old son, Nick Alfano, who's DMing.
I was naturally much more shyer as a kid, and then still until I started actually doing Adventure League stuff and then actually DMing, because for the longest time I was just playing. But DMing for a bunch of different people, bunch of strangers, over and over again, really gets you past the whole, you know, public speaking thing.
Nick grew up watching Joe play with his friends in their living room. Then, in middle school, his dad taught him how to play.
Like, there's lots of big in-jokes at this point for how long we've been going on.
It's a wand of paralysis that she had forgotten how to use.
Wow.
It's otherwise been real bad for you.
Magic stick.
Magic stick.
And that's what this game does. For 50 years, it's been bringing friends and family together, strengthening relationships, transforming people, and likely will for years to come.
I'm like, great, I'm just start taking off and running as soon as he's important
so
and dialing.
WPR's Anna Marie Yanni brought us that story on Dungeons & Dragons in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lolan Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin is the global epicenter of a vegetable with a first recorded use over 3,000 years ago. It's horseradish.
Hunzinger Farms in Eau Claire has been around for nearly a century and labels itself as the world's largest grower and processor of horseradish.
At the tail end of harvest season, we take a tour of the farm as it transitions to winter. Mackenzie Crummy reports.
It's fairly loud in here today. We're washing horseradish at the moment, so.
Are we gonna wash some horseradish?
You want to?
Heck yeah!
I'm at the Hunzinger Farm on Eau Claire's south side. We are in a warehouse where the smell of their signature vegetable, horseradish, is pungent. I'm with
Kyle Beckel. I'm the farm manager here at Hunzinger Farms.
This century-old family business tags itself as the largest grower and processor of horseradish in the world. They farm nearly 1,000 acres of horseradish annually. And this root crop is in the ground anywhere from 12 to 24 months. If you've never seen raw horseradish before, well, it's difficult to describe.
I would best describe it as almost like an octopus-looking type of root. So there's a main root, and then there's secondary roots that kind of branch off of that main root, anywhere from 6 to 24 inches long, and anywhere from a pound to, we've had some roots upwards of 5, 6, 7 pounds.
Washing is the final step before the horseradish is sent for processing to be ground and made into sauces. 5 people are in front of the conveyor belt inspecting the root by hand.
The horseradish is washed in here, and then it comes out here onto this belt for a final sort.
And so how much horseradish do you think goes through this belt in a day?
In a day, anywhere from 10 to 40,000 pounds a day.
After washing, we move to one of the 2 root coolers. This is where the horseradish is stored. Between the two buildings, there's around 4 million pounds of horseradish.
What are you doing right now? You peeling off the edge?
Peeling the skin off the radish for you, you to try some.
Are you going to try some too?
I sure can.
Is it going to be spicy?
It should be spicy.
Are we going to do this together?
Cheers.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
I think I took too big of a bite.
Yeah, this stuff has a little heat in it.
It's like kind of coming through your nose.
Very pungent.
Oh my, a little nibble I took. But it tastes good though.
Yeah, this is very good.
Your eyes are watering.
Yeah. Plenty of heat in this rut.
Kyle says the strong flavor is actually a defense mechanism the vegetable produces to deter animals from eating it. The crop and its life cycle are so unusual, but so is the machinery. Here is Kyle describing the planting machine, which is an altered potato planter.
All of the seed that we make during our sorting process gets boxed up and set up on top of that platform. And as the planter drives through the field, there's a little bell on there that dings. This is a ground-driven bell chime, I guess you'd call it. So that's about how fast they're dropping seed right there. So we plant roughly 7,000 seeds per acre.
Wait, hold on. So yeah, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 seats literally on the planter. And a person sits in that and drops an individual seed down the tube. Yep. Every time.
Yep, 8 seats. 8 people planting and then one guy up moving the boxes around, keeping seed stock in front of everybody, and then another guy driving the tractor. So it's a 10-person process.
Like potatoes, the seeds of horseradish are snippets of the plant, and Kyle said people are cutting roughly 4 million seeds annually.
I mean, I had no idea that this farm existed. Like, when people come to do tours, are they like, oh, global epicenter of horseradish, who knew?
Yeah, we do get that reaction. People know about the horseradish, but they don't realize, I think, everything that goes into it, you know, all the behind-the-scenes stuff. And I think that's true for most products that you consume. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff that people don't realize go into it.
Mackenzie Crummy, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Special thanks to Sarah Hopeful for technical direction. Now we turn to Eric Rigg, president of Silver Spring Foods in Eau Claire and the fourth generation to run Hunzinger Farms. Eric, welcome to Wisconsin today.
Good to be here.
Well, we just learned a lot about a horseradish in its current form. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of horseradish? Been around for a long time, used as food and medicinally, I understand. Give us a little history of horseradish 101.
Yeah, horseradish has been around for a long time. And actually, I'll tell you a little story about the name. Horseradish kind of grew by the Black Sea, and the Germans called it Meerrettich, which means sea radish. And we believe that the English, a long, long, long time ago, misinterpreted Meerrettich as in female horse radish. And so that's why we kind of stuck with this name of horseradish. It has really nothing to do with horses, and it's not even a radish. It's a root.
It was surprising to me to learn that we have such a big player in the horseradish business here in Wisconsin. Can you tell us, take us back to, 1929 and how this farm got started and then how it went into horseradish?
Yeah, so our farm, Hunzinger Farms, was started by my great-grandfather, Ellis Hunzinger, in 1929. We are this year celebrating 95 years as a family business. I am a fourth-generation horseradish farmer. But Ellis, when he started, you know, was actually just falling back on farming. That's what his parents did. He was a door-to-door lightning rod salesman here in Eau Claire area at the time, and I think there's only so many repeat customers you can get on lightning rods. So he fell back on farming. This is, you know, again, right before the Depression. He started growing on a little bit of land here in Eau Claire, and he grew like everyone else. You know, some of the typical crops you'd expect, some strawberries and some potatoes and melons and corn and horseradish. Horseradish, I think he started because of his kind of German background. Hunzinger is German. And he married a kind of Scandinavian, Norita. And so I've got kind of a German and Norwegian a mix. But anyhow, the horseradish was what really took off. One of the cool things about horseradish for this area is he was able to grow it all year long, pull it out of the ground, and he could sell it during the winter months. So it was really for economics that kept him alive. And horseradish really flourished in this area. We are near the 45th parallel here. And so we're kind of just, the climate is about perfect. Horseradish likes cold weather to kind of bulk up for the winter. And if you get into some more southern regions, a lot of the energy goes into growing these big, beautiful green leaves, which we actually don't do anything with. We want a big, hardy, bulky root underneath the soil. So the winters here are great for horseradish. If you get too far north, then the growing season isn't long enough to develop a suitable crop. So we're kind of in the perfect place, soil type for the horseradish that we grow here.
I got to ask, you're a kid growing up in a horseradish family. Like, did you instantly love it, or was it kind of an acquired taste over time?
No, I did not absolutely love it all the time. In fact, my dad grew up on a dairy farm up in Washington State, and their family made ice cream. I learned that the Rigg family had sold the dairy, and we weren't going to be making any ice cream anymore, but we were going to keep the horseradish side going. And I, as a 12-year-old, thought, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Let's keep the ice cream and get rid of the horseradish.
First of all, what I call the whoosh, right? That feeling of strong horseradish, and it just explodes in your sinuses. That's part of the fun. What's causing that?
Great question. So we actually would call that the zing. And we developed a heat index for horseradish called the zing factor. I was so curious about, you know, what was actually going on in the horseradish to give it that zing that we ended up putting in the research and development to create our own heat index. Think of it like Scoville units, how they measure peppers and the capsaicin in peppers and how hot a jalapeno is relative to a habanero. Well, we developed that index for horseradish. Totally different chemical than capsaicin. The chemical in horseradish that burns your nose and makes your eyes water that we love so much is called allyl isothiocyanate. It's a mouthful, but basically the more of that in there, the hotter the product will be. And it is the plant's defense mechanism. So the horseradish root itself isn't hot. If you pull it out of the ground, cleaned it up a little bit and put a little bit in your mouth, it wouldn't burn you. What happens is if you start chewing on it, it releases this enzymatic reaction that generates this allyl isothiocyanate, this zing factor. So the more you chew it, the more it releases this blast. So when we are grinding the horseradish, we're basically mimicking that chewing process. We're breaking it down, creating all this heat, and then we're trying to encapsulate that with the vinegar that we use to kind of stop that reaction from happening, preserve that heat. And one of the things with horseradish is that it is not like wine. It does not get better with age. It is the hottest the day we grind it, and it loses a little bit of its heat every day after that. So one of the things to do with horseradish is check the code date, look for fresh products, and make sure you're using it before it loses its zing factor.
Eric, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Eric Rigg is president of Silver Spring Foods in Eau Claire and the fourth generation to run Hunsinger Farms, which is the world's largest grower and processor of horseradish. Earlier in the program, we heard from farm manager Kyle Beckel.
A big shout out and thank you to everyone who donated during our year-end member drive.
It's support from people like Bruna in Platteville
and Jolene in Chippewa Falls
that makes WPR's essential service possible.
If you missed joining in, there is still time at WPR.org. When you do, be sure to ask for your WPR wool socks for $15 a month.
You play an important role in keeping Wisconsin informed, inspired, and connected.
Thank you so much for your partnership, and thank you so much for listening to Wisconsin Today.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to WPR News.